Hi there, this is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the N. Savvides Podcast. This is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of working well with others to do great, creative, imaginative things. Our guest today is Evan Kidd. He's a filmmaker here in Baton Rouge, and he shot a number of short films, music videos, corporate video projects, and more. Recently, he completed his first feature film, Son of Clowns, and it's got a remarkable story to it. Evan made the film for about $2,000 for a feature film, and he got it on Amazon Prime. That's quite an achievement. So we walk through the process of making the film, from meeting with the actors to shooting to editing, the film festival process, and finally getting it on video on demand platforms like Amazon Prime, not something that every filmmaker achieves. This episode is chock full of ideas that you can use to bring your film to life. Without further ado, our interview with Evan Kidd coming up next. Stick around.
This is the N. Savvides Podcast. Hello, hello, hello.
Evan Kidd, welcome to the N. Savvides Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Nick. Glad to be here.
You've worked on a couple of projects at this point. You recently put together your first feature film. So at what point did you realize that you were ready to go for the feature?
You know, I think it came after doing a series of shorts, which, you know, is pretty common among many indie filmmakers. And you kind of get to a level where, you know, you've done several shorts and it's kind of like, now what? So I kind of hit that now what moment, and it kind of just occurred to me that there really was no set path per se to easily make a feature film in a way that, you know, felt relevant and felt right. Obviously, there is Hollywood and there is, you know, getting a big budget and all that. But to be someone in their 20s or, you know, any age really, and have that happen is extremely difficult and extremely slim to none chances, if we're being completely honest. And so I've really been a fan of micro-budget filmmakers, people like Joe Swanberg and Mark Duplass, and people who've kind of come up over the last 10 years making films, you know, by their own accord, if you will. And so kind of watching their model was extremely interesting to me, because the stories they were telling, you know, yeah, they didn't have big explosions or aliens or any giant backdrops, but they did have a lot of heart. And I like that. And, you know, for me, I like a film that has a good story, regardless of the budget or the effects. And I kind of saw a trend of these, you know, micro-budget films focusing really strongly on character, I guess more out of necessity, because they don't have budget for, you know, giant backdrops and all that. But there was something interesting going on. And so I kind of, you know, formulated my own story for Son of Clowns, my film, and tried to fit that mold in a way that made sense and in a way that told the story. And so for me, it just seemed like a natural fit to try to make stories that could, you know, go into that mold, if you will, and then be applicable to making it on your own.
All right. So we'll talk more about Son of Clowns in a moment, but let's talk a little bit about some of your short films. I had a chance to watch some of them, and I noticed that you've gotten better in working with actors. I feel like the performances have improved from one short to the next. So talk a little bit about some things you've done in the way that you work with your actors to get the better performances.
Absolutely. I think that casting is one of the key parts to making a film. You know, who's going to be in it, right? And so when I work with an actor of any kind, I really want to meet them long before we film, long before any day on set, and, you know, just really get to know them and ensure that the, you know, decision we're making is going to be the right one. Especially in the micro budget film world, you know, there's a lot of hungry people who just want to act and just want to do it, which is great. And I think the world needs that drive and that spark, but there also has to be something more than just wanting an IMDb credit or just wanting, you know, something for your resume so you can get a bigger paid thing later down the road. You know, that's all great and that's all crucial. But, you know, for me, it was really just finding people who connected to the story. And I think finding the earnest and sincere people who really want to dive in and sink their teeth into a meaty role is really the first step. And then from there, once we're on set, my process is really to try to be a, you know, conduit for creativity and ideas. You know, I've got my notes and, you know, my binder with everything. And, you know, typically I've directed a few shorts and other projects that I haven't written, but 90% of the time I direct stuff that I write just because I enjoy being a writer director and familiar enough with the material to kind of, you know, be comfortable with it. Once I've gotten a take or two my way, I like to, you know, open it up for interpretation and say, hey, what do you guys think? That way, when we're in editing, we got a little bit of ability and room to play, which I always enjoy.
All right. So just to expand on that, it sounds like you're spending a little more time finding the right actor for your roles. Yeah. What sorts of things would you hear from an actor that make you think, all right, this could be a good fit? Or what sort of red flags come up in the conversations?
Sure. I think anytime you work with an actor, you know, you kind of can, you know, as corny as it sounds, you can kind of see it in their eyes. You know, a lot of time when I do auditions, whether it's in person or through something like a self-tape where they film themselves and they send it to me and I watch it after the fact, you know, you can kind of just in a weird way tell. And obviously, you know, the performance is the strongest thing that's going to speak for itself. But, you know, I really like when actors take initiative, when they follow up. If I haven't gotten back to them immediately, if someone sends me an email, you know, a couple days later, not, you know, in an annoying way, but just saying, hey, hope you had a chance to check it out. Look forward to hearing back from you. You know, one sentence, that's it. People who just take initiative and show interest, I think that really speaks volumes. And especially once they do have the part, you know, a lot of times actors, once they get a part, they'll just kind of wait for instructions, which, you know, that's the standard. Nothing wrong with that. But I've had a few of my actors and especially some of the leads from, you know, this past film I did, Son of Clowns, they would hit me up with an email a couple days before the shoot or weeks before the shoot and say, hey, what do you think about this? I created a little backstory for my character. I had one of my actors even Skype me just because he wanted to talk about that. And I mean, you know, that's all extra work that doesn't have to be done. But when it is done, I really think it opens up the integrity of your film and kind of gives you more room to be true with your characters.
Yeah, they're being proactive. It's not like right. You're always prompting them or they're showing up late, like 30 minutes all the time.
Yeah, that's a red flag for sure.
Yeah. All right. Another thing that sticks out to me about your work, you have very distinct music that you use. So what's the process there? Are you reaching out to musician friends? Do you have a couple of go-to places that have really delivered for you for the music mm-hmm. that you use?
Yeah, you know, I'm a former drummer. I still drum, but I come from a world of music. My dad's a guitarist, and, you know, there's a lot of music in me, regardless of any film I make. So, you know, when I make musical selections for a project, I really try to take the time to make sure they fit, especially in micro budget. I typically don't have any budget, if we're being honest, left over for music. Very rarely, if ever, do I have money to spend on that. So a lot of that is actually coming from a combination of, you know, luckily I know some very great local musicians, both, you know, here in Louisiana and back home where I'm from in North Carolina, that occasionally will want to contribute a track or, you know, maybe even if they have the time, create something entirely new. That's a luxury I haven't had as often as, you know, someone who says, hey, I've got a track, or me saying, hey, I like the track and would you be willing to contribute it? We'd love to, you know, promote your band and the project and on our social media. In the instance of Son of Clowns, we created a entirely unique soundtrack for the film, and that all the local musicians from North Carolina, where the film was shot, were, you know, all local. So the entire soundtrack stayed in the state. And the composer as well was from the state, which was really interesting. And so, you know, it kind of gives it a interesting flavor you may not get if you've got a person here, a person there, and all that. So it's definitely something I haven't done as often, but maybe we'll try to do a little more in the future.
Yeah, that makes sense. Finding musicians who are maybe in a similar point in their career as you are as a filmmaker and kind of teaming up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice to be able to, I think musicians kind of get it, maybe even a little more than filmmakers. A lot of times there's kind of a, you know, stigma against doing something for free in the film world or just doing something for fun or whatever. And I think that's, you know, it's important to keep an aspect of, you know, respect to the craft and that, you know, there are people who make a living from this. There are people who gaff or boom operate for a living, and that's their, you know, livelihood. For those people, they may not be the perfect fit for your micro budget project. You know, they may not be able to just take that work for reduced or free pay. However, I do think there are people who might be interested to create something or people who might be willing to take a risk, whether they're, you know, a pro or not, you know, a student, someone else. So I think it's just, you know, expanding your horizon, and the musician seems to get that. I had maybe one musician turned me down out of everyone I asked for the Son of Clown soundtrack, and everyone else was very willing. I don't know. You know, I knew a few of them, but most of them I had never met other than just an email saying, hey, I liked your songs just as a fan. Would you be interested in collaborate? Local musicians. I'm not, you know, reaching out to, you know, any giant bands or anything. You know, it's, I think, a sign of artistry when one artist can help another.
And it sounds like they've been more inclined to work with you than some other filmmaker types.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it's difficult with other filmmaker types to, you know, always get crew. You know, cast is a little bit easier. I think there's a little more of a hunger in the cast world. But I think with crew, I've had a couple project shorts where I've had to, you know, be the DP. Which I do a lot of DP work commercially, part of how I make my living. So I'm very comfortable with it. But, you know, if I have my druthers, I'd much rather just be a director on the day of and not worry about camera. You know, I can do it in a pinch, but it's one of those things where you'd prefer to not have to, so you could focus a little more on the performance. Quick turnarounds don't yield results if, you know, you've only got 2 weeks notice and you're asking people for favors. So, you know, I think it takes a certain kind of flexibility to just, you know, do it yourself, but also understand that not everyone can drop what they're doing and come help you. So it takes an interesting mentality to do this.
It's not just that you have compelling music. It seems like you have a real appreciation for the performer in your work. I mean, you see it in Son of Clowns with the family that actually does perform as clowns, but also you did Spazfest and some others. Talk a little bit about getting a sense of what the performer personality is like.
Yeah, I think I can relate to it quite a bit. You know, I'm not a actor by trade. It is something I've kind of studied and had a little bit of experience with in, you know, early on before I really decided to do filmmaking. So maybe that's kind of part of where that comes from.
In addition to doing music, you did some acting work as well?
Very minimal. Yeah, just very minimal dabblings and like, you know, high school stuff and nothing, you know, huge, but just, you know, enough in little group projects and for fun things with friends to kind of just get a, you know, taste of it, I guess, if you will. But I have an appreciation for it. And it's something I was very interested in before I decided I wanted to do filmmaking. Plus the musician background I have with drums kind of lends, I think, a little bit to that artistic view that I have and kind of in my work. I'm interested in just seeing the world through an artistic lens. If, you know, we're being honest at the end of the day, an artist has a way to, you know, speak to people and things that a business can't or a politician can't or, you know, this and that. And so I think it's really important to amplify those voices, whether it's someone else's or maybe your own.
Would you elaborate on that? How can artists see things differently than business people or politicians or whoever?
Sure. I think there's a responsibility where you can definitely have a viewpoint that's, I think, a little stronger, but also a little bit more abstract at the same time if you're an artist, if that makes sense. For, you know, Son of Clowns, there's a theme of depression and alcoholism throughout the film and kind of how people deal with that. And, you know, both the person who's the victim and the people who have to take care of them and are affected by their choices. Through good legislation, a politician can do quite a bit. But a lot of times that takes years and years and years. And so I think, you know, showing someone maybe not so on the nose, if you will, to an issue like that, you know, through a film like Son of Clowns or any other film that deals with those matters, you can show someone without saying, okay, this is a person, this is what happened to them. I'm going to kind of point a finger and say the statistics versus saying, okay, let's just go on a journey, see a person, you interpret as you will. Because that's the thing about film. The director is not narrating the film, you know, while you watch it. You're kind of inferring your own choices and projecting your own thoughts as you watch any film. So I think maybe that way your, you know, mind is a little bit more kind of deciding things as you watch and kind of taking in those ideas and viewpoints.
All right. So let's talk a little bit more about Son of Clowns. As you said, you have someone who is dealing with depression and substance abuse. Was that the driving force for the story or a mix of things?
It's definitely a mix of things. When I first had the idea, the very genesis of Son of Clowns, I wanted to do something that was dramatic, but not entirely so. I had just done this short called Displacement Welcomed, which was very dramatic, not a lot of comedy. There's a few little laughs to break it up every now and again, but, you know, it was pretty cut and dry for the most part. And while I wouldn't classify Son of Clowns as a comedy strictly, I think it probably has more comedic elements, maybe dark comedy, but, you know, comedic elements than any of my other previous works. And so for me, I kind of was thinking, what's the weirdest slash most interesting way I can challenge myself as a filmmaker to make something that is, you know, dramatic in its core, but kind of wrapped around this comedic shell, if you will. And I think a lot of times, you know, as they say, comedy is kind of tragedy. And, you know, there is drama underneath all of it. And so I kind of wanted to think, okay, clowns, that's something weird. And, you know, we kind of see them in this very stereotypical light, you know, as a, you know, horror movie clown or just, you know, some general, you know, Bozo the Clown, silly kind of thing. But kind of who are those people? The film really is not about clowns. There's only really clowns and makeup for about 5 minutes of the whole film. But it's really about the, you know, in between when the people take off the makeup and clean their face and kind of what they do in between the show.
There is that poignancy and tension between trying to entertain others and be engaging and then dealing with personal issues. And also, I guess, trying to rediscover a sense of wonder.
Yeah.
In what's being done. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. For Hudson Cash, our main character, he's on this journey, not really to be a clown. You know, that's his parents' dream and his parents' business. And, you know, he helps where he can, a lot of times begrudgingly so. At the end of the day, he's got his own ambitions and he's an actor and he's just lost his, you know, quote unquote, big break in Hollywood. And so he's back home in North Carolina trying to discover the endless question, what's next? And so, you know, I think he's lost his sense of wonder. And I think in terms of trying to discover it, that's really where the film takes you. And, you know, I won't spoil anything, but through a series of events and certain individuals that he meets, I think he slowly finds a way to build it up that he may not have thought of previously at the beginning of the film.
I wanted to touch a little bit about the look of some of your projects. Displacement Welcomed has a nice color palette to it, as does Son of Clowns. And it seems like you did some of the color grading for that. So talk about that and any kind of tools you use to work on that side.
Like I was saying earlier, a lot of times in micro-budget filmmaking, at the end of the day, I can pull a crew together for the shoot, but usually post is on me. But a lot of times, you know, you can't be a chooser in micro-budget film, and you kind of just have to decide, okay, am I going to take on these three extra roles? Or is the film just not going to happen? And I want to live in a world where the films get made. And so, you know, if I don't do it, nobody will, at least at this stage. And so, you know, I'm hoping that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I might to be, you know, lucky enough to be in a position where I can have more people come in on the back end and kind of help with post. But for now, it's on me. And I'm okay with that just because I know that's what needs to get done in order to make the film.
So, for Displacement Welcomed, what tools were you using to help you get the look?
We shot that almost exclusively around Golden Hour, just because I kind of wanted it to have this, you know, kind of crisp golden look with hope, just because that storyline has a lot of hope and redemption in it. The parts of Greenville we chose to film in were, you know, oftentimes back alleys and run down abandoned buildings and, you know, bulldozed lots. It's kind of an interesting juxtaposition between those kind of desolate backdrops and the parts of town we filmed in for Displacement Welcomed. And then the, you know, bright, crisp golden light we got from sunset and everything else. And a lot of that was also created in post. And I used Adobe Premiere. I used the color grading within the editor to do that.
With like the Lumentree engine that they have in the newer versions?
Yeah, it's actually pretty powerful. It's very technical, and I'm not a very technical person, but I took some time in classes to really hone color correction because I really think that's a way to make your film pop like nothing else. Achieving a palette is really important. It's often understated, but it's, you know, subconsciously what people perceive when they watch your film. And so, you know, I think getting that right is critical. It's, I don't think, enough just to say, oh, you know, it looks good, I'll throw some contrast on it and call it a day. There's really a tweaking of every single shot that you have to do, almost like photo editing. I was a photo editor at East Carolina. It was like my part-time job when I was a student, so I had a lot of experience from that. So I think a little bit of that trickled through And then the program I actually did over there was an arts-based program where we had to take painting classes and do color theory. And a lot of that I sucked at. I can't really draw to save my life. But, you know, a lot of those lessons kind of carried over after the fact. And I think helped understand that color sensibility with the film.
Yeah, it's good training to have that attention to the color palette. It seems like you did spend some time on Displacement Welcomed and Son of Clowns. So yeah. For both, sticking with Premiere, were you using any plugins like Film Convert or anything like that?
No, I kept everything for both Son of Clowns and Displacement within the editor. I have used some plugins for music videos and other projects, you know, corporate ones or, you know, anything else. And I might use them more in future narrative works I do. But for those two, I kind of wanted to, you know, both stories are very of life and very, you know, very simple, honestly. And, you know, I kind of wanted to keep the color, you know, away from being too flashy, away from being too in your face. You know, it's definitely got a look for sure. It's definitely intentional in the look. But I think at the same time, if you're not, you know, trained in it to find that look, you probably would never notice it and you would just kind of experience it. You know, I kind of wanted to keep it simple because, you know, a lot of times if you watch, I don't know, this is a bad example, a Michael Bay movie, you've got those really intense colors, yeah, you know, coming at you.
There's a place for that too. But I mean, you're right. Your story, if it was like blinged out music video kind of colors, would probably be distracting for what you're going
right.
for.
Right. Yeah. I shoot a lot of hip hop videos actually. And so in a lot of those videos, I'll, you know, make it very intentional and, you know, the colors will grab you and kind of pull you in the story and be very, you know, in your face or maybe the opposite, depending on the song. For these, it was a little more simple and subdued in terms of the tone. So I kind of wanted, like you were saying, the color theory to match that.
Let's talk a little bit about your shooting schedule, because you shot Son of Clowns in 10 days, I believe.
Yeah. I can't believe we did that.
That is crazy. I mean, most of the time for a film, if it's like 25 days or something, that's super rushed. Yeah. So walk us through, how did you manage to get everything that you needed for a feature length film?
It, you know, it is crazy. I wouldn't recommend it if you have your, you know, choice.
So you're getting like 2 hours of sleep each night or something?
If that,
Wow.
it was nuts, man. It was the most grueling shoot I've ever done in my entire life. It was wild, you know, but it was a trip too. I wouldn't trade it for the world. But, you know, if I had my druthers, I would definitely want to spread it out more. The reason we kind of got into that, we weren't originally planning 10 days, but our lead actor, Adam Ferguson, who plays Hudson Cash, he had to have another commitment for a different project right after we did Son of Clowns. So we really had this like 2 week window within to shoot the 10 days. And it was insane. You know, we had like 1 or 2 days off in the middle, which was nice. But I mean, there was like a chunk here and a chunk there, and then we were basically done. And so it was intense, grueling, and, you know, a proving ground, I guess, if you will, to, you know, who really wanted to be there. Because if you didn't want to be on that set, it would have shown. So, you know, I got really lucky because it was grueling. It was intense. But we had fun. You know, it wasn't a miserable place. It was a place where, you know, creativity was welcomed. We had a lot of crafty to get us through and a lot of coffee, but it definitely was insane. You know, I remember we shot 3 days in Wilmington and the folks who play the parents, April Vickery and Eric Hartley, they're an actual couple in real life. And they actually opened up their actual home to us to film in. So that was their actual house. And we kind of just decorated it with the props to make it look more circus themed. But, you know, there were a lot of, you know, staying around that area, sleeping on air mattresses, you know, and just be living in the very space we were filming at. So it was kind of like a retreat, if you will. Again, it's not always the most ideal way to make your film. But like I was saying earlier, you kind of make those choices. Are we doing this in 10 days or are we just not going to do it?
Obviously, we're not encouraging people to do it all the time, but let's say say they're on a crunch, that they need to cut down time. So one of the things you said, you were sleeping at the location where you're shooting or very close to it.
Yeah.
I imagine you're not doing a lot of location changes each day.
Some days we actually would. One day we actually had a location change that was 3 hours away.
Ah,
but it wasn't one ambitious. Of the, it was on the like a whole other side of the state. But it wasn't on that day where we were, you know, sleeping around the same area. So the days really varied. the average length, I don't even know what it would be. You know, I would guesstimate like 14 hours, and we had one that was pushing 20. I mean, it was really, you know, we couldn't have done this through a union or, you know, anything like that. And that's not the way I want to work forever. Absolutely right. Not. But everyone knew what they were getting into. There were no surprises. It wasn't like, you know, because that's the worst thing you can do is not be upfront with someone.
Right. So you weren't telling people like, oh, it might be like 5 or 6 hours.
Yeah.
And like, and two more hours. Like, come on. Hours. Can you right. do one more? Can you do one more? All right.
Yeah. No, I mean, everyone knew what we were getting into. And, you know, I told people, I said, if you didn't want to do this, it's okay. But I told them that from the get-go, like before they were even cast. And so, you know, that was the kind of transparency I wanted to have. I don't want to pull any weird crap on anyone. I don't want people to walk away saying, oh, I didn't like working with Evan Kidd. I want people to say, oh, I'd love to work with him again. So, you know, that's my goal anytime I make a film is really making people happy, you know, making people enjoy what they're doing and forget that it's work, because it should be art. It shouldn't really be work.
So you mentioned that one of the things you did was have nice crafty extra snacks for people to at least relax for a little bit.
Yeah. Break areas, all that stuff. My producer cooked a couple days and his wife cooked a little bit.
That helps.
My girlfriend sent
treats. So you don't have to have people say like pizza again for the fifth day.
Yeah,
come on, man.
Yeah, I've all said week this long. Before. Yeah. I was going to say, I've said this before in a few other like interviews and podcasts, but like after a few days, you really hit the pizza wall and you just can't eat any more pizza.
But like two days, 3 days in, yeah. And then that's the max.
Yeah. You're just like, I can't eat any more greasy food.
Another thing that I noticed, it seemed like a number of the shots were handheld or at least not on a lockdown tripod. And that gives you a little bit of speed as well. So what were you using? Do you have a handheld rig that you liked?
Yeah, we had a handheld rig for the Canon C100, which we shot on. My director of photography, Ned Phillips, he would occasionally take the camera without anything, but we also had like a shoulder rig and a monopod and a couple other things. We did have the tripod for, you know, like a couple shots, but not, you know, very seldom. The whole film was mostly kind of moving. And I think, again, like you mentioned, it was really a conscious choice to kind of give the film a sense of, you know, present, you know, keep it present and just make things a little more immediate in, you know, what was going on screen. And it also definitely helped keep the pace of the day moving from a production standpoint. Looking to future works, is that what I want to do all the time? No. But again, I don't think it really always matters what you, you know, want to do in your heart of hearts. It's really what will serve your story best. And I truly believe that's what served our story the best.
Are there particular tools that worked well for that fast shooting style in addition to the handheld rig?
Yeah, just on a filmmaking cinematography perspective. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we had the shoulder rigs, the monopods, everything like that. We really just tried to travel light. We had these little LED lights that were great. We had a couple soft boxes that took a little more time to set up, but we had these little LED lights you could change the temperature on, and they were battery powered. So a lot of times you didn't have to lay the cable as often. You didn't have to, you know, worry about gaff taping everything down. It was just kind of more immediate. Without those lights, we probably would have had 2 extra days, if I'm being honest. So just little things. Yeah.
All right. So you're shooting at a quick pace for that film.
Right.
Did you find that it added some extra time in post as a result, or it wasn't too bad?
I definitely see that it added some time in post. I don't know what our shooting ratio was, but, you know, we probably got about 3 to 4 takes of everything, sometimes a little more. A couple times even less, but, you know, we had a pretty consistent ratio to where we had a couple options to play with in editing, and that definitely dragged things a little bit in a good way. When it came to post, I actually was cutting this film while I was working a full-time production job that was completely independent of the film at the time, and so I would really cut this film by night, and it was a pretty grueling half year of post-production because it was really just me. I would send, you know, drafts to my cinematographer and my producer just to kind of get their thoughts along the way for feedback and, you know, scenes to cut. And, you know, we did cut some scenes and shorten the film by about 25 minutes from the actual script, which was quite a bit. But we just really wanted to make something that was, you know, tight and consistent and didn't drag too much. And so, you know, I definitely think that kind of lengthened the post-production decisions. What will we cut and, you know, what will we create from all these different takes? And but I mean, you know, that's really what everyone goes through. And I think if I had just had the one job at the time of, you know, just cutting, I probably would have cut the film sooner. But, you know, kind of doing two full-time jobs, one by day and then one by night, which was cutting this film, it's pretty grueling and kind of mimicked the, you know, 2 hours to 3 hours of sleep a night we did during production just for me for about half a year after. So it was grueling, but, you know, again, I wanted to live in a world where the film existed. So that was important to me.
And when you're also the editor, you have that luxury. It's like, all right, well, it might take a little longer, but I know that I'll be doing it. So
yeah,
I have
that. There wasn't a huge deadline. You know, there were a few festivals we wanted to hit, which luckily, you know, come February, we finished everything with the film. So we were able to send to the festivals. But I mean, from about July of 2015, it took us till about December to hit our first, you know, final rough cut. And then from December to February of this year, 2016, was, you know, just cutting scenes and remixing a few things and then color correction. And then, you know, once we picture locked, we were done. So it was, you know, a long and grueling process. But, you know, again, it's just, you know, kind of what we were talking about earlier, what needed to happen in order to see the film through.
I want to take a quick break from our interview with Evan Kidd to tell you a little bit more about some of the things I do when I'm not working on this show. I also do various film and video projects, either my own or ones where I help out in various ways. In fact, I was director of photography for episode one of Evan Kidd's upcoming TV series. We'll talk more about that later in the episode, but I've been doing various film-related things for a couple of years now, whether in the camera department or editing or in some other aspect of production. So if you have a film and you need an extra hand, it's possible I might be able to help. Shoot me an email, tell me what you're looking for, and I'll see what I can do. The email is podcast@ncevides.com. Once again, that's podcast@ncevides.com. All right, now let's get back to our interview with Evan Kidd. Talk a little bit about the collaboration process, specifically when you're in post. People have done their jobs, you're editing, you're getting feedback. How did your producer and your DP give you notes?
Yeah, so I was in Louisiana and they were in North Carolina still. And so, you know, I would cut something together and export it and then send them a link on Vimeo, just a private link. And they would view it and kind of write me an email back, or we would Skype about it and just kind of hit me with some timestamps and, you know, ideas of, you know, hey, I didn't like the way the scene flowed. Is there another take, or, you know, this and that. And I mean, they knew at the end of the day that I had final cut, but, you know, I'm not really the type to discredit someone else's ideas. You know, I talked about being very collaborative with the actors on set, and I wanted to keep that sense of collaboration and creativity going even through post. And, you know, once you're in post, especially as an independent filmmaker, you feel very, you know, alone at times. I've got this whole big project that all these people came together for, but really, if you're the only editor, it's all on you. And you're just sitting there with a drive with a bunch of files at the end of the day. And so it's kind of up to you to turn it into something. And so, you know, I think there is a bit of a responsibility there. So it's nice to be able to, you know, have that outside perspective, you know, because I've been slaving away at this thing for 3 or 4 months at a time. And, you know, I would be, you know, kind of desensitized to it in a way. And so, you know, to get a fresh set of eyes, I thought was, you know, very invaluable. I know there's some filmmakers that don't like a lot of outside influence and work in their work, and especially if someone says they don't like it. But, you know, I don't think all films are for everyone, and I don't think all films, you know, have to be liked by everyone. So I love a convergence of different ideas and opinions. I think that's what really makes filmmaking great.
To an extent, the people you're working on in a film are trusting you or the filmmaker to make something that they can all be proud of. And there are going to be different sensibilities. And initially, at least in my experiences, there's that feeling of like, are you going to make me look bad? What are you doing here?
Yeah.
So how did that unfold for you all?
Yeah, it was definitely, I think, something that grew over time. We, you know, we knew each other fairly well, but nothing cements friendships like making a film together.
Or ruins them or puts them at risk.
Or ruins them, yeah.
It could go either way.
Case. Absolutely. Yeah, you'll either make or break it. You won't come out the same either way. But we gained a trust making the film. And then you kind of go on hiatus, if you will, once it's done. And then, you know, you're cutting and cutting. And, you know, 3 weeks may go by and you don't send anyone a cut. And then you send someone something. So, you know, about once a month, you'll, you know, hear from home base, I guess, and kind of make those decisions. That's kind of the way we did it. But, you know, I just love that collaborative process. And, you know, I wouldn't have traded it just for, you know, my own opinion, because your own opinion's great, but it is very limited.
In looking back, how did you develop that trust? Were there things that you did, specific moments that you can point to?
Yeah, there has to be an understanding with your producer, DP, confidant, you know, whatever you want to call it, when you're making your film in post. They're allowed to speak their mind without feeling like they have to sugarcoat something.
Be absolutely blunt, like, hey, I mean, this is just not working. We absolutely need to change this.
Right. And I mean, even it's hard. Like, even my DP would tell me something, you know, he's like, dude, I spent so much time lighting this shot and it's a beautiful shot, but it just doesn't work in the film, you know, and it doesn't matter how beautiful the shot is, you know, and coming from the DP, you know, it's hard to say that, or it's hard for me to say that to him or the producer or anyone. But like, you know, you just have to really do it as a part of the greater whole, not so much, you know, hey, I want my one great shot to be there. You know, you can always take that and put it on your reel independently if you want to. So, you know, really the time to focus on the story is when you're making that in post.
Yeah, that's great that you had that, because you're right. Sometimes people can be territorial. It's like, right. I don't care about the story. This is my beautiful moment and you're cutting it out. It took us like, you know, 4 hours to light this or whatever.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a super dramatic scene in the movie that, you know, I loved, and it was originally probably like 15 minutes long. And the final version is maybe like 8 minutes. But, you know, I remember my producer saying, like, I love this scene until it hits this moment, and then it just drags for me. And it wasn't on the actors. It was just on the length of time. You know, do we want to spend that time in that scene, or do we want to get on to the later parts of the movie and keep pushing the story? So, you know, if you look at it that way, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you always have your favorites in terms of, you know, your babies, if you will, when you make a movie in different scenes and all that. But, you know, if one is your favorite, you have to be prepared for what if it doesn't work all the way, or what if only half of it does its function and then the other half is disposable. And I mean, it's the hardest thing. You really do have to be kind of a, you know, giant asshole towards your own stuff in a way. You know, you have to be okay with that. And, you know, at the time it might be rough to hear, but, you know, now I'm sitting here in December of 2016 and I'm looking back and I'm like, you know what? I don't miss it. It's on the little DVD for bonus features if people want to watch the deleted scene fully, but the half of it that we used, I think it's better for it. And so, you know, a lot of times just taking that perspective really helps. And, you know, I know a lot of filmmakers just pretend like it was all their idea from the very get-go, but, you know, it's a collaborative process. And like, you know, even myself, when someone didn't tell me something, I would watch a scene and I'd be like, yeah, you know, I don't need that whole scene. I just need a sliver. And it tells the same story. It just does it in less time.
It sounds like honesty served you all well.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit now about the festival experience for y'all. You all recently concluded your festival run, from what I understand. So what was that like? Were you heading to all the festivals where you got accepted, or were you very selective about where you went?
Yeah, we pretty much did all over the globe in a small scale. You know, we did a lot in North Carolina. We did a screening in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We did one in Atlanta. We did one in Maryland. And then we did one in Los Angeles, as well as doing one overseas at the UK. So, you know, we really just wanted to get this film seen by a lot of different people. North Carolina has a very strong tie in the film. So we, you know, targeted a lot of those festivals, and probably the biggest one being our final festival, which was at the Kukulorus International Film Festival in Wilmington. And that was an extremely awesome experience. You know, they flew me out there, put me up and everything. And it was, you know, truly, I think, the best film festival I've ever been to. And I hope that other filmmakers and, you know, film fans and enthusiasts are able to check out their work.
When you're a micro-budget filmmaker and you're traveling to these festivals, that can add up. I mean, you have the cost of submitting to film festivals and then travel and then possibly bringing along other people in the production. So talk a little bit more about those decisions. Was everybody coming along? Were you all covering travel for anyone? And what did you consider a successful use of money for your festival route?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I always say there's a fourth step of production called promotion, and it comes after post. And you got to show people the film and get it out there, or else what did you spend all this time doing? For me, that's incredibly important. Nowadays, through social media, you've got a great platform, but you know, you want to make sure you're doing more than just getting, you know, likes and followers. You want to actually make sure people are engaging with your content. And I still think going out to a festival and kind of shaking hands and kissing babies, I guess, if you will, just, you know, showing people the film, having a conversation with them afterwards is the best way to do it. So for me, I tried to go to every film festival I could. I had to miss a couple, both for, you know, cost because it was too expensive or had something else going on. But for the most part, I got to every festival we went to, with the exception of the ones abroad, but just for that factor of cost. But, you know, I mean, it came out of my pocket, and that's kind of the decision I wanted to make. And, you know, luckily, they were spread out enough to where I could kind of recoup from one between going to another. And a lot of times, you know, like the one in Los Angeles, I have a friend out there who was incredibly gracious to, you know, let me crash on his couch. So really the only thing I had to pay for was airfare. Little things like that, asking friends for favors or trying to look for something on a budget or getting a travel roommate or something can always help. It's really a decision that you have to say, okay, is this festival worth going to? Because there are some festivals that absolutely are. And, you know, a lot of the bigger ones, like, you know, when I went to Kookaloris, they were gracious enough to, you know, cover my cost to get there. So, you know, they're lucky that they can do that. But that's the only one that did. You can promote and shake hands and people can meet you. And I think at the independent level, there's a yearning for that and that people want to meet their filmmakers and, you know, say, hey, when's your next project coming out? Or can I keep up with you online? You're in those kind of niche groups. So I think it's good to take advantage of that. And, you know, you're getting, you know, maybe 20 people here who become fans or, you know, 5 people there from that festival. And, it, you know, it adds up over time. And I think that's how you develop a following and that's how you get people to care about what you're doing.
So was that one way you'd gauge the effectiveness of it? It's like, oh, okay, I got 20 people, 20 new followers or 20 new people on my newsletter or whatever it is?
Not per se. I mean, it's definitely nice because it's a, you know, tangible way to say, okay, I guess this was worth it, you know, monetarily or whatever. But, you know, I think part of it is just the experience. I think every filmmaker should experience a film festival. And as things move more and more and more online, I don't think we're going to live in a world without festivals, but I think that their role may be changing. So I think, you know, now if you have the chance to go to festivals, like, please support them because, you know, they do good work and they're really the only avenue outside of, you know, seeing something online later for independent films to get seen in a traditional theatrical setting. And so, you know, I think it's important to preserve that because it's my favorite way to experience cinema. For that reason alone, people should be interested, especially if they're filmmakers.
Were you able to bring along any of your filmmaker collaborators for any of these festivals?
Yeah, for a few of them. Yeah, like actor, well, we did in Atlanta was great because, you know, it was a big city and one of our actresses, Anne-Marie Kennedy, already lived there. So she ended up moving out there. So she was already there. And, you know, I drove up from Louisiana. My lead, Adam, he drove down from North Carolina. And then we all kind of met in the middle. For regional ones like that, that were kind of close enough to where people could drive, we all came out. We did a lot of screenings in North Carolina where we had like supporting cast members and our producer, DP. Like our premiere we did in North Carolina, and we sold out a theater, had like 150 seats, and we just really hit the ground running. And this was in the, you know, the town in Raleigh, North Carolina, where we shot the film. And so, you know, we had that hometown draw for sure. But, you know, we sold out this 150 seater and we had pretty much every single cast member there except for like 2 and almost every crew member too. So, I mean, that was the epitome of what I would want. And obviously that's your premiere, so people are a little more invested to go out. But after that, it's really just a matter of, you know, who has time because, you know, a lot of these people are working on other projects, you know, myself included. But I definitely think when you have people there, like I said, to shake the hands and say, okay, that's the guy from the film. Wow, that's the actor. It's a nice way to engage with your audience a little more than if no one shows up and it's just another film in a slot that, you know, they, you know, hit next on the projector and roll the next one.
Were you or the production able to help some of the key people involved cover some of their expenses for these? Or again, it's like, hey guys, this is a micro budget.
Oh yeah. I mean, we did this Indiegogo back in January and we got the costs to basically submit to all the festivals. And I mean, like you were saying earlier, it's expensive enough to submit to a festival and then there's no guarantee you'll even get in. So, you know, we used up our back end budget, really submitting to festivals. And then, you know, I lost plenty of my own money just deciding to go to festivals. I mean, I, you know, Son of Clowns cost me money at the end of the day. You know, maybe I'll gain some back in VOD, but that might take 3 or 4 years. I knew this was never going to be a giant moneymaker, and, you know, so did the cast. And I think, like, when it came to deciding, are we going to this festival or not? Yeah, we kind of threw it out there and said, okay, hey, I'm going to be there. You know, Bradley, our producer, will be there. If anyone wants to come, this is the time and date, you know, no pressure, but we'd love to have you there. Kind of the same way the festivals do it. And so kind of just keeping it open, there wasn't a huge incentive, I guess, aside from the actors just wanting to come and, you know, meet people. And I think a lot of times they did. We had actors show up to almost every screening in one form or another. They just wanted to be out there. I think for them, it's important to, you know, kind of do that same networking for their own side of things.
Without singling out a particular film festival, were there one or two where you felt like it wasn't a good investment of my time and money? And if so, why? I mean, what was it particularly that wasn't a good fit for you?
Sure. Yeah, I've had that happen before. I won't say which festivals or if it happened. Yeah, I appreciate every film festival, you know, regardless of what they offer or don't, just again, for what I was saying earlier, for just being committed to showing independent film. I do think there are some festivals, you know, where things get a little shady and people just kind of do it more as a moneymaker and, you know, they kind of show some stuff and don't promote it. And I've been burned a few times on a couple of those, but most of those were earlier on in the filmmaking game when I was doing the shorts. And so I kind of quickly learned, both through personal experience and then hearing other kind of horror stories from other filmmakers about festivals, you know, which ones to stay away from. And I think if you go on Film Freeway now, they've got a rating system. And so you can kind of read comments that people leave who were actual filmmakers. You know, you're not allowed to leave a comment unless you were chosen to screen there at one point or another. So it's verified. And I think that's a great way to do it. And, you know, a lot of times my trick also is, you know, look at their social media, look at their graphic design. Does it seem up to par with what they're attempting to do? You know, not saying everything has to have a PR team, but after about 5 minutes of investigating online, decide for yourself if a film festival looks, you know, viable for you.
Are there specific things to watch out for? Like if they have, I don't know, photos of themselves downing martinis with celebrities and that's all they have, is that like, that might be suspect?
Yeah. I think a lot of times if they are able to draw celebrities, I think that's great. The vast majority of film festivals are not overflowing with celebrities and a million producers trying to throw money at you for your next project. It's just a good way to network and meet other people who do what you do. It's kind of like a conference, if we're being honest. Yeah, you know, you've got like Sundance and some other big festivals. And we were in, you know, Kugelhorst Film Festival, which was a pretty big festival too. And, you know, they had some great opportunities and, you know, I met some incredible people networking. And I think that's the biggest thing, is to go with an open mind to network and maybe not expect, you know, all your filmmaking problems go
away.
Like
you're going to get shine, kid. We're going to put you there. We're going to get you in front of a big studio,
Yeah, that kind of old mentality. I think throw that away. You'll save yourself a lot of heartache and anguish. But, you know, if you just go into it with an open mind, being like, yeah, I'm going to meet some really cool people who like to do what I do and maybe can help me with a future project, I think you're doing it the right way. For me, it's almost like a vacation. I really didn't take any vacations for the last 2 years. I just went to film festivals and called it that. Because, you know, for me, I'm in my element when I'm around film.
On a different side of what we're discussing, Kugelhorst has a reputation for being very filmmaker friendly. And you touched on how they put you up and helped you with travel. But can you talk a little bit more about some of the other things that they did that made it a filmmaker-friendly experience, if that was the case?
Absolutely. Yeah, they were just great in every sense of the word. Like I said, I'd been to some festivals where I had to like chase down the, you know, screener and say, hey, it's, you know, 10 after, the film's not showing, what's up?
Who are you? Oh, your film is showing. Oh,
yeah, nice to meet you, sir. You know, you drive four hours or whatever, but. You know, it is what it is. But, you know, I mean, yeah, for Kukaloris, I mean, it was the most professional film festival I've ever been to. I mean, I'd been for years and years growing up in North Carolina. I'd gone since high school just, you know, to check it out. You truly get some of the best representation of the big films that are playing Sundance and South By, but also like interesting independent films that are regional and international that, you know, you may not see at South By. So it's a huge mix. And that's what I love. And I mean, not to mention they've got shuttles and free food and some free drinks, which is always nice. And, you know, they just make you feel at home. They really, you know, say, hey, if you need anything, here's a point person. Don't hesitate to let us know. I mean, it's just little things like that that really just make it feel like you're being heard and valued, which is, you know, just nice because there's not always a lot of that.
Right. As opposed to like hurting industry. You. It's like, come on, Pete, we got to keep it moving. Come on. It's a tight ship. We're running here. Come on.
Yeah. You don't feel like you're a cog in the machine. And I've had other great film festivals, you know, do that. Longleaf Film Festival in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is my hometown. And then Longleaf Film Festival. And then the one in Atlanta was called Yollywood Film Festival. I love that name, by the way. But it was a truly great one as well that, you know, just made you feel welcome.
All right. So your film festival run is now over, at least for Son of Clowns. And now you're going through video on demand. It seems like you've done some on Amazon Prime and elsewhere. So talk a little bit about that aspect of it.
Yeah, Amazon Prime. This is my first experience with it. I think they take shorts now, but back when I did shorts, I don't think they did. So, you know, I had a feature this go around. So I said, you know, hey, let's approach someone that's reputable. Cause you know, before that I was always wondering, where is this film going to end up? And we really didn't know that until about August. So, you know, we just didn't have a clue what would happen. And so when it came to Amazon, it just made sense. They had a pretty agreeable, a deal. I guess I had a couple other small offers, but I mean, it was nothing to be honest with anyone. And I mean, the Amazon one is really nothing if we're being honest either, but you know, I never went into Son of Clowns looking to like flip a car or flip a profit to go buy a car or something. So it just made sense to go with a reputable platform that would be seen, you know, Amazon, almost everyone has Amazon Prime, and I can tell my friends, hey, Son of Clowns, it's available right now on Amazon Prime. And they're like, oh yeah, I use that for the shipping. I have that. And so then they'll, you know, go home and watch it. So, you know, I think it's a great way to get in people's living rooms, if you will.
So it sounds like it's not going to bring in masses amounts of money, but it, I mean, there is some revenue sharing.
Yeah, there's revenue sharing. And it's, you know, based on the amount of people that watch it, and there's specifics I can't discuss, but it's very, very basic and affordable. No one's getting rich off of Amazon Prime, not that I know. I tell people all the time, there is a lower middle class group of filmmakers, and that's where I sit. And, you know, it's pretty much the next, I think, generation of creative people. You know, I think you're going to have fewer and fewer big budget films that are, you know, original ideas coming. I think it's going to be a lot of sequels and a lot of quick cash grabs coming out of Hollywood. And so I think you're going to have a more sustainable middle class, especially now that the, you know, technology for making stuff, getting cameras, et cetera, is pretty affordable. So I think more people are getting in the game, and I think that's kind of where people are going to be at.
To give filmmakers listening a better sense of what it took, would you be able to elaborate a little bit on the budget? You don't have to give specific numbers if you don't want to, but I mean, are we talking tens of thousands? I don't know.
No, not even. No, okay. I mean, I'll be happy to give specific numbers. Okay. I mean, we made Son of Clowns for pretty much next to nothing. I mean, I think our final budget was somewhere around 1800 to 2000. I mean, it was pretty much, you know, in the terms of making a film, pennies. Like, I had to go do a freelance gig in between one of the off days to, you know, put some more cash into the film. So, you know, I mean, it was just me doing it because I wanted to do it. And I, you know, didn't see an avenue for this film to get made, you know, with any sense of urgency if I didn't do it this way. And so that was just kind of the decision I landed at. And then, you know, we fundraised a little bit of money after the fact. That's something I would say if you're ever looking to do Indiegogo or Kickstarter, you know, it's great to do it beforehand, but it's really hard. I think if you do it after the fact, people can say, okay, here's a product. You can show pieces of what you shot. You know, obviously you're not going to have that money for production, but you can have it for promotion and film festivals, which, you know, like I said earlier, is what we did. And that's pretty invaluable. So we, you know, got a little boost out of that. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, when all is said and done, I think it may have been around 3,000.
Okay. And then what about travel expenses and festival promotion? Is that separate or is that included in?
Yeah, I didn't even include that. I mean, you could probably kick that up another little notch with that.
Like another maybe 2,000 or so.
Yeah. I mean, if you, you know, crunch the gas and food and all that and plane tickets, but you know, I tried to keep it really minimal. I only flew out about once or twice. So, you know, it was, you know, not horrible. You know, like I said, I didn't take any vacations for the last 2 years. So I just kind of chalked it up to that. But yeah, you know, there's a way you can do it. You just kind of have to be frugal.
Were you ever getting any percent of the ticket sales on the festivals besides Amazon?
No. Mm-mm. I'm sure there are some, but I didn't have that experience.
Okay. So you might get a small percent of it back through Amazon, but maybe not entirely.
Yeah. I wouldn't expect, you know, unless, you know, everyone listens to this and goes out in droves and watches it, you know, which would be great. But, you know, I wouldn't expect to recoup every penny we spent on Son of Clowns and then some, you know, not for several years. I mean, maybe after it's, you know, sat there for a while, it'll probably do it. But, you know, I don't expect to see that within, you know, the next year.
But it sounds like it's manageable, right? I mean, compared to some other filmmaking stories you hear where they say like, oh man, I spent like 50 grand on this. I had to refinance my house. I sold my car. And
yeah, I would don't do that. That's my advice. Don't, I mean, unless you just want to make trouble for yourself, but there should be no need. Like, I don't know. Some people are like, oh yeah, it's really cool that I went into all this debt and lost my house to make a film. I don't think that's a sustainable way to be creative. I don't like that. So, you know, I definitely took a hit. I definitely had to eat some ramen and, you know, do what I needed to do to make it happen with the film. But, you know, at the end of the day, it wasn't a life or death situation, thankfully. And I think it's just, you know, like I said, just trying to be smart and do that and decide what works for you. And, you know, my thing is planning pre-production, not only with the film, but with, you know, budgeting on your own life. And, you know, if especially like I'm doing, I'm taking out of my personal money. So, you know, it definitely had a artistic conversation, but also a personal conversation. So if you do those things, you can set yourself up for, you know, some variation of success to make it happen.
Yeah. And you're also doing filmmaking as your day job, right? I mean, you're doing corporate gigs and
yeah,
music videos, and that's bringing in some money for you, right?
Right. Yeah. And like I said, I worked a, you know, full-time job for almost half a year doing that concurrently with editing. So, you know, just like you said, was a way to, you know, be smart. You know, I think there's some people who say this is all I'm going to do. But if you do that, you kind of limit yourself. And so I would rather do a couple different things and have a way to make another film, even if it comes out of my own pocket. You know, the goal is not to have it come out of your own pocket every time. But if you're able to keep yourself going, I think that's a good way to go.
Yeah, or at least to make it, if you are spending money, to make it manageable so that you can do more as opposed to it taking so much time and resources, yeah, and then that becomes a limiting factor. What are your plans for the future? Are you hoping to do more micro budget features, or do you want to do one that's going to be like, okay, that was good, now I want to do one that's you know, higher budget, yeah, and all that sort of thing?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I just, you know, want to make films and I want to tell stories, and however way I can do that. I'm writing a new script now. I've got another micro budget. This time it's like an episodic little TV series. And we're going to shoot that next year in Baton Rouge. And I'm really excited about that. But, you know, that one is pretty much the same way we did Son of Clowns, pretty much next to nothing. But, you know, it's just an idea that I see an opportunity for with some people I know here. And, you know, I definitely don't want to let that go to waste. And as far as, you know, like you said, doing bigger and better things, maybe down the road with a higher budget, I would absolutely love to. You know, I'm writing a new feature now. And, you know, maybe if I meet some more, you know, fundraisers and producers, we can kind of put that up into place, because it would require a little bit more money, just because it's a little bit more conceptual in what the nature is. It's more of kind of a thriller with some little sci-fi elements. So, you know, it would require a little bit more to get it going. But it wouldn't be, you know, unachievable. So, you know, I think it's like taking those baby steps, maybe doubling, tripling your budget every time or whatever, just to see what you could do. But, you know, if that doesn't happen, I'm totally okay to make another micro budget film. If a bigger offer comes along and they're saying, hey, Evan, go do the next Star Wars spinoff, I'll be like, sir, yes, sir. So, yeah.
Do you want to tease out a little bit the one that you have for Baton Rouge coming up, or you're not ready to discuss?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. It's we don't have anything out promo-wise just yet, but that will be coming in the coming weeks. But the show, it's called Home Remedy, and we're hoping to send that one out through a kind of video-on-demand service like Amazon Prime or Netflix, somewhere where you can kind of binge-watch all the episodes at once. And so we're, you know, shoot a season during, you know, maybe January to April of 2017. And have, like, it's pretty much all self-contained one season. Maybe more could come out of it, but really the whole plot line is encompassed in that one season. And just, you know, really making something that's kind of a little more comedic and a little more, you know, on the nose in certain funny ways. And so, you know, lending a little bit of that drama that I like to do in there as well. But it's really about a guy who essentially treats people as a therapist, but he does it under the table. So he kind of makes house calls and goes and has a series of interesting conversations with a whole bunch of different people. And that's where things can kind of get a little wacky.
Yeah. Are these going to be like 30-minute episodes or?
Yeah. Yeah. So without the commercials, it would probably sit around like 20 minutes or so each one.
Right.
So something, you know, kind of short and sweet, but digestible. You know, there was a great show on Netflix that Joe Swanberg did called Easy. And there were 8 episodes of that. So I'm thinking probably about...
That'd be interesting. I'll...
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really good one. I would highly recommend it. But, you know, we're looking about 6 to 8 episodes for this, for Home Remedy. And then, you know, trying to see what other projects we want to do after that.
Okay. Well, Evan, last question for you here. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of you?
I would say that anyone that's interested in collaborating, let's talk. I would love to be creative. I'd say my best skill set and when I'm at my best is not really only a budget thing. It's when I feel that I'm surrounded by people who care about the films I'm making. Obviously enough to invest money, sure, but also on a, you know, storyline level. Are we doing a film that matters? Are we doing a film that makes sense? And anyone that would be willing to take a chance like that, I would absolutely welcome as a collaborator.
All right, great. People want to learn more about you and some of your films. Where would they go?
Sure. You can go over to my website. It's rocksetproductions.com. And then I also pretty active on Twitter. You can just look me up at Mr. Evan Kidd. And then all the Son of Clown stuff, including the streaming link. It's now on Amazon Prime. You can just search it. And that's all at sonofclowns.com.
Yeah, and that's really the best way to watch it. If they want to support you, go on Amazon Prime. And if they're not on Amazon Prime, they can still rent it, right?
Yeah, you can just rent it. It's $1.99, so, you know, cheaper than a cup of coffee.
Yeah, that's you're not bringing it. It's like, hey, $20. $20, kid. Yeah, you want to watch it? Come on. All right, very reasonable. People want to support it. It's a nice way to do that. Okay, Evan, thanks so much for chatting with us, and best of wishes on your upcoming projects.
Thanks, man. Had a great time. Appreciate it, Nick.
All right. And that's my interview with Evan Kidd. Now, I want to share a few things that relate to the things that came up in the discussion. First of all, it's great to see how open Evan is to collaboration. And as someone who worked with him on his series Home Remedy, I can attest to that. It's one thing to give it lip service. It's another thing to really be open to ideas from anyone. And you heard him discuss in the interview that he would do an edit and share it with his director of photography and producer. Doesn't always happen. A lot of times when you're in the midst of the edit, there's the inclination to say, well, I'm working on it and I'm going to do things this way. And I don't know that I want to hear feedback. Maybe they're going to say something critical. And it sounds like they did give some feedback. That was constructive criticism at various points. And so it takes a certain openness to say, well, even so, I'm going to share with them. It doesn't mean I have to agree with their take. Maybe that idea isn't going to work for this thing, but I'm at least open to it. And these people who are working with us on projects, they have their own areas of expertise, and they are, to an extent, trusting their reputations with us when they work on our projects. If we put together something and it looks horrible, then people are going to say, man, who shot that, or who was the producer for that, or the actor, right? I mean, the actor might have given a good performance and it gets edited badly. It's a level of trust to participate in a project and see where it goes. And so that's very gracious of Evan to acknowledge that and say, all right, guys, what do you think? Let's talk about this. What works, what doesn't. You also heard Evan talk about the importance of being connected to a community. That was how he was able to get a lot of the music for his films, and they have very distinct sounds to them that feel so appropriate. I even suspected that he might have had some custom written music for certain moments. So having those connections within the community can help. And for me, we did the interview together, and that led to me working as director of photography on the show. They approached me about it afterwards, and it had even slipped my mind that he was like, oh yeah, that sounded interesting. Let's talk about it. So there are benefits to being connected and saying, hey, let me just engage these people. Along those lines, Evan had done a documentary a while ago about a music festival called Spaz Out. And one of the main characters talks about the reason he does what he does. He puts together this festival, even though he loses money in it. And I see parallels in the things that we discussed about how sometimes you work on a film and you lose money in it, but you still want to be involved in doing it because it has something special to say. It has something relevant that goes beyond monetary value. We all want to make money from our art. Nothing wrong with that. If it happens for you, I'm happy for you. But that's not the reality for a lot of people. There's some really, really talented people who aren't able to make a living entirely from their art, subsidized by another job or other sources of income. So it's just that reality to be mindful of. And so the question is, when that reality comes up, is it something that we still want to do? And if so, why? I like what Evan had to say about acknowledging the artist's point of view, that it has value beyond what a business person might have, or a politician, or other members of the community. They all have valid things to contribute. We need everybody in our society. It's not like it's just about artists or athletes or whatever, but artists are the people who often take time to break down those moments, explore the underlying issues, say what others might not say. You have someone in a business context, he or she might not take the time to try to express what's really going on. There are deadlines, job pressures. Maybe there's a risk of losing a job. If the deadline's not met or whatever, speaking out when it's not favorable to do so might cause a politician to lose some votes. But artists can say, well, let's explore this issue. Let's see what it's all about. Let's put a human face to it. There's value in that. And sometimes that value goes beyond the monetary figure. Evan, very smart in being able to keep the cost low. Sometimes these films cost tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars or more. They don't always make it back. So it's helpful to consider what value it offers even beyond a financial return. We can't always promise that, but maybe we can offer something else to go along with it. It was also quite generous of Evan to share the budget. There's sometimes privacy about that. I mean, if you mention a figure that is too low, people say, well, then I don't know that I want to see it. Or if it's too high, then people say, well, you spent all of that to make this? Why? Where did the money go? So it's a generous thing to say, hey, I want to share. I want to do this to encourage fellow filmmakers and other artists trying to develop their work. Look, getting a feature film made at all is an accomplishment. getting it done for $2,000 on a 10-day shooting schedule, it's insane. Not the typical thing. Not to say that the film Son of Clowns is perfect, but maybe it's not about perfection. This podcast isn't perfect. I try to clean it up a little bit, try to make it polished and get rid of some of the filler words and things that aren't as precise as they could be. But if I were to go through and get rid of all those things, it would take 3-4 times as long. And then that's time away from something else. So that thought of perfection is sometimes a trap for artists. It's something I've been thinking about a bit more lately. If you study something formally, you learn, well, this is the way you're supposed to do it. And they tell you, here's how to do the lighting, 3-point lighting. You have these nice sets. And that's great if you're working on a Hollywood production. You have a big studio backing you. You have big budgets. Big banks are giving you the money to make it happen. Doesn't always work. So sometimes it's about saying, well, what's the best thing for the project, as Evan said? What will help this get made? And maybe that means making adjustments. Maybe having a perfection mindset actually gets in the way. We might push back on that. Like, no, we want it to be the very best version of what it can be. Of course we do. We all want to do our best. But in context to the resources at hand and what makes sense for the effort, for the business of it, if you will. I mean, let's say we have a director of photography who is so obsessed with perfection that he says, well, I want to make sure this scene is beautifully lit, and that's commendable. But what if it takes him 7 hours to do that? And then that one location you had for just a day, you have to get it again. That doubles the cost of the location. That becomes a hindrance. So it's helpful to think about it. How can we aim for good quality, excellent quality, and still work within the constraints of what we have available to us? Along those lines, Home Remedy was another production where we didn't have all the resources, but I was still captivated by the way it came together. Really compelling story, some really talented actors involved. And going back to what Evan mentioned earlier, he was upfront about what's involved. And I think that's a big part of it. When you let people know what you're working with, then they have the choice to say, okay, I want to get on board or not. And then a lot of people understand. Maybe these are up-and-coming actors or people on the crew side who say, I hear you. I understand there are sacrifices. I think this could be a chance to get experience, and it could be a good opportunity to connect with people. I'm in. But imagine if someone says, hey, we're doing a Hollywood project. It's going to be huge. It's going to be terrific. And you go, and then you're saying, wow, what's the deal here? Where's the salmon? Where's the chives that I want to put on my artisanally crafted bagel with all of the toppings? And you only have one flavor of cream cheese? I prefer strawberry cream cheese. Thank you very much. Kidding aside, there is value in working on projects even when you're not getting paid, or maybe you're not getting paid as much as you'd like. As Evan suggested, there is some stigma around working for free or at a reduced rate. And I understand that. There are reasons to be wary. A couple of people out there are unscrupulous and are just looking to take advantage of people. But sometimes it's just a matter of saying, hey, what am I getting out of this, and what is this person offering? Many times for a filmmaker, they are going to be spending weeks or months of their lives putting together a film, getting the resources together to make it happen. And quite often, they will lose a considerable amount of money. So an actor is coming in and has the chance to work on their craft, to get some kind of visual documentation of it. Most of the time, you're going to get the footage. You're going to have the film available in some form. And they are possibly spending, say, 2 or 3 weeks of their lives. Maybe 4 weeks, including prep or learning lines, getting to the shoot and whatnot. So in some cases, there is value. Of course, for people who are already booking the big gigs, if you're Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie, probably not of value to work on something at a reduced rate or free rate, because you can work on anything. But maybe it's a chance to do a project that someone wouldn't normally give you the chance to do. Let's say someone is passionate about underwater basket weaving, and they envision Angelina Jolie in this part. Now, she gets a lot of parts. Maybe she doesn't get that. She's really hoping someone in the Discovery Channel would please call her for that, but she just doesn't get those calls for whatever reason. Someone comes along and says, hey, I really want you to be in this. It's my passion project for 20 years, but I can only pay you the SAG base rate. Can you still come on board and help a fellow out? And maybe that's a chance for her to do it. It really broadens her career as she gets to do all the underwater basket weaving sequels from then on. I'm just saying it's a possibility. So there is value in considering it specific to the situation, saying, all right, what is this project going to offer? What kinds of people are involved? Is the filmmaker someone I trust? So I would encourage you all to consider it. There's room for flexibility, and sometimes it's beneficial for both parties. Going back to Evan's film, Son of Clowns, it is a film that's got a lot of things to like, even though it was shot on a low budget. For one thing, the main characters have a warmth to them. There's a real connection, a real chemistry to them, and there is that sense of wonder. You see it a little bit in the colors. You see it in this guy who's surrounded by clowns who are trying to make people happy, but he's trying to find his way, his meaning in life after he faced a setback. So that is compelling to me. The art direction also has some nice decorative flourishes that really sells the clown-like atmosphere in a whimsical way at times, and other times in a more subdued way. So it is a film I recommend. It has some weight to it, dealing with topics like depression and alcoholism, as Evan said, but also in the context of someone within a clown family trying to rediscover a sense of joy. And there is real human connection, a real sense of joy and vulnerability on occasion in the film. And I would say that makes it worth seeing, if not taking a look at it and seeing how you can think about making films in a cost-effective manner for $2,000 or less. That main character in Son of Clowns is a kind of wounded idealist who may have had a sense of wonder but lost it and trying to find his way again. You have a similar kind of character in Home Remedy, a guy who's going around doing home visits to help others, but he also has his own issues that he's trying to resolve. And those kinds of characters are ones that resonate with me. Why exactly? I don't know. I mean, I have my own hangups. I'm aiming for better things, but sometimes I get tangled up along the way and I'm trying to get better, trying to have a positive impact while trying to get my life in order. So maybe that's what it is. Or maybe it's just a broader appeal. Maybe we all connect to that in some way because we see variations of ourselves on film, on TV, and it nudges something in us, where we can acknowledge our own issues when they're displayed elsewhere dramatically. It gives us some distance from ourselves, and maybe that can help us process what's going on. Maybe even in some situations, it can give us the perspective and clarity we need to get better and fix the underlying issue. I've mentioned in the past that the number 23 sometimes comes up for the episodes I do. I don't know why. It's kind of strange how it does. And this time around, we were going to do a pickup shoot on the 23rd, February 23rd, to be precise, for Home Remedy. But it got canceled or rescheduled. So like, all right, well, what does that mean? The number is fading somehow from this show. Maybe. But then I was looking on the Evan's site. It turns out his short film, Kin, was released on May 23rd, 2013. Now, there are 7 films on there that had a date, 1 in 7. That's pretty good odds, but it just so happens that Kin is the short film that most relates to the first feature-length screenplay I ever wrote. So there's that. It's strange. What can I tell you? All right. Well, in any case, I do hope you'll take a moment to check out Evan's film, Son of Clowns. It is on Amazon Prime. If you have Amazon Prime, you might be able to watch it at no cost, or you can rent it at like $2. It's like an extra cup of coffee this week. I'm sure Evan would appreciate it. And if you connect with it, why not shoot him a message? He mentioned he's on Twitter. You can send him a shout out there or on Facebook. It's the little things. When it's not just about money, getting that little pat on the back can be an encouragement. So check it out if you're so inclined. There are a couple things that I think are worth seeing about it. That's our show. What thoughts do you have? Have you seen the film? Are you curious about it? Have you tried to put together a micro-budget or not-so-micro-budget film? Would be curious to hear about it. You can share your experiences in the comments or shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. If you want to encourage me, I could use some encouragement as well. Try not to get into too much trouble, you know, stay off the mean streets of Baton Rouge. Try to do something semi-productive. Well, if you want to do that, you could write a nice review on iTunes, shoot me a message about the show, why you like it. All those things help, and they take like 3 minutes or less. Again, if you want to reach me, it's podcast@ncivitis.com. Music for the show provided by Rob Coslow, beginning and the end, little bits. It's the song True Gemini. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.